Welcome to Off the Page. I'm Stephen Copeland. 2025 is the 800-year anniversary of St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of the Creatures. This poem has had a unique and foundational place in Italian poetry, and it reflects Francis's deeply relational spirituality as he names different elements of creation as brother and sister. The circumstances from which this poem arose, however, may surprise you. When Francis wrote these beautiful words in the Canticle, his life was actually quite bleak and miserable. This episode's guest argues that the Canticle flowed from Francis's spirituality of letting go, which he learned to practice throughout his life more and more. This, she shares in her April 2025 cover story in the St. Anthony Messenger, is its own invitation to each of us. It's an honor to introduce to you our next guest on Off the Page, Dr. Darlene Prides. Darlene is the academic director of the Master of Theological Studies Franciscan Theology online degree at the Franciscan School of Theology in San Diego, California. She has taught at FST since 2001, and she has a special interest in lay Franciscan spirituality and leadership. She's a historian, she's a scholar, and she's the author of Women of the Streets, Early Franciscan Women in Their Mendicant Vocation. So, why is a spirituality of letting go so vital for our hearts and our minds? How can it lead to peace and freedom? How does the Franciscan approach to letting go align with other religious traditions like Buddhism? And how can St. Francis of Assisi and his life circumstance from which the Canticle flowed out of be a model for us in our own lives? We explore these questions and more in this special episode celebrating the anniversary of St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of the Creatures. One final thing, to keep the episode at an hour, we did not include reflection segments this episode, but you'll find that Darlene speaks in such a deliberate and contemplative way that I invite you to pause throughout the episode whenever your heart feels stirred to do so and reflect on what she said. So there's no shortage of Franciscan Lectio moments for you to choose from in a conversation with Darlene Prides. So without further ado, here's our next guest, Darlene Prides. Darlene Prides, this is way overdue. Welcome to Off the Page.
Hi, Stephen. Thanks for this invitation. I look forward to our conversation.
I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to dive into your April 2025 cover story in the St. Anthony Messenger. Your cover story is based around the Canticle of the Creatures here in this year where we're celebrating the 800-year anniversary of this beautiful Italian poem. So to begin, can you tell me about the first time that you read St. Francis of Assisi's Canticle of the Creatures and what impact it had on you?
Yeah, so full confession, I read it the first time as a freshman in college, and I read it alongside the Little Flowers of St. Francis, and I hated them. I really just hated it. I found it sappy, I found it sentimental, I was really dealing with a lot of stuff around religion and Christianity, and so I didn't like all the God talk. And as I've said this in other forums, this is how God works, right? God hooked me this way because I just started studying Franciscan history after that. It was a way for me to try to understand Francis's life story. And what happened, I went and got a PhD in Franciscan history. And along the way, I eventually returned to the faith and started rereading the Canticle, rereading the Little Flowers, and coming up with a deeper appreciation. But I'll be honest, it's only within the last few years, as I've gotten older, that my appreciation for the Canticle has really deepened as I, you know, understand how Francis came to write it and come to understanding my own life trajectory and entering into this last phase of life myself. The Canticle has a richer meaning.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about that depth of meaning and how it kind of bloomed for you? And maybe that'll get us into explaining the background to this poem. Because I think when a lot of people read this,
at least when I first read it, it was just like, this sounds euphoric. This sounds kind of, frankly, naive.
Yes, yeah.
Like this flowery kind of poem. And then as I started to learn more about it as well, I was like, oh my gosh, the period of time from which this arose is really quite remarkable. So can you take listeners into that for me?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for a lot of us, especially the first time we come to reading this canticle or hearing the canticle, we assume it's from the young Francis. You know, for those of us who've watched Brother Sun, Sister Moon, Zeffirelli's movie, we think it's about the young Francis running through fields and with music of Donovan in the background. But no, it really comes near the end of his life, the last year of his life, that he starts composing it. So it's really a representation of his mature faith, and he has gone through so much, and it's not just a simple trajectory. It is a complex life of ongoing conversion, ongoing transformation, ongoing letting go, even of some of his most beloved thoughts and aspirations, perhaps, aspirations for his community. I think the way I view the canticle now is I start situating it around 1220, when he is letting go of leadership of the friars. He recognizes by this time not only is his health declining, but you know he doesn't have the capacity to be an administrator, an organizer, a manager of a growing order of men. My colleague Bill Short uses this phrase that I just love, and I think it encapsulates Francis's way of being so well. You know, he was clearly charismatic, and people were attracted to him, but he couldn't organize lint in his pocket. That's it. He couldn't organize lint in his pocket, but he couldn't organize a whole group of diverse men. So he lets go and renounces his leadership of the order. And what happens to him when he retires from leadership? It's what happens to any of us when we retire or let go of a task or a project that we really love. It's hard to let go. He starts observing what the other guys are doing, and he says, no, it's not supposed to be like that. You know, what are you doing? I don't even recognize you anymore. He gets petulant. He gets angry. He does all these very human things and has all these human emotions that I really appreciate. He's not this simple, sentimental guy who can just run around in the woods all day long. No, he's really feeling it.
He's unashamedly himself, it seems like.
Absolutely. He can't help himself. He's Italian, you know, he just can't help himself. He lets go with his emotions, and he's really quite petulant with his brothers. And this one passage that I especially like is like, I don't even recognize you anymore. I don't even recognize it. Who are you? So it's a depiction of him, but it's an honest depiction. And it's actually probably from the Assisi compilation, because that's the compilation of stories from his companions where we get the real gritty Francis, right? The real Francis. And I appreciate that. And so he did have to wrestle with his own emotions. He had to wrestle with letting go. He had to wrestle with his health.
Yeah, and what were some of the health issues he was battling at this time in his life when he wrote The Canticle of the Creatures?
Yeah, well, he had this chronic eye disease that was very painful, and ultimately, at the friar's insistence, he sought medical attention, and the doctor cauterized his eyes, so you can imagine how painful that is. He didn't eat well. He didn't take good care of his body, so he suffered from malnutrition and weakness. So he is declining in health along this way.
In a very real sense, he's nearing his deathbed, correct? Like his weakness, his frailty.
Eventually, and that's why I'd like to see this across, however, 6 years rather than just the last year of writing the canticle, because I think the background is necessary. He's ongoing letting go, letting go, letting go. And finally, when he's in at San Damiano being cared for by Claire and the sisters, and he's surrounded by mice, who he apparently doesn't like mice and rodents running around him. He's in pain, recovering from this cauterization treatment. That's when he says, "Praise to you, Lord, through brother sun, sister moon." When he's finally composing the canticle, he's at this place where he's already given up so much. He's processed all of these emotions and all of these situations, and situations that don't rest easy with him. What does he find himself? He finds himself surrounded by God through all of creation and all these reasons to praise God through all of creation. He might have had to let go of this, that, and the other, but he still has God. He still has his faith. And so now, far from being the 18-year-old freshman, I just had my birthday. I'm 64 years old. I'm just now finally grasping the depth of the canticle. And it can bring me to tears. It can really bring me to tears.
What stirs you so much emotionally at this time in your life about the canticle?
Well, I think it's his life story and that background to understanding the composition. Because I, too, at this point in my life, I've had to give up a lot of aspirations, a lot of expectations of how my life would go. And when I really sit with it and reflect on how I was battling with letting go of things, but now that I have let go of many, many hopes and expectations of my life, I realize how much more beautiful life is, and that with my faith and with the natural world around me, with the relationships I have, there's so much beauty, so much more beauty than what I had been hoping for. So it's his life story and then reflecting on my own life story that gives me the capacity to really see the canticle in new light.
Yeah, we're going to get into the spirituality of letting go, of releasing ourselves of our attachments, these things that we're clinging to. I find myself always clinging to things, thinking that that thing is going to convince myself that I'm like whole or complete when all along, you know, it's that dynamic you're bringing us into that we'll go into later. It's in letting go. It's almost as if there's more space for, truth to flow through. But I wanted to get into something real quick. The context of you writing this cover story, it's no surprise that you very early on in your cover story, you get into this element of suffering that you've been describing in Francis's life. But you yourself were going through something quite unfathomable, and your loved ones were at the time that you were assigned this cover story. Can you go into that?
Yeah. So I was writing this in January of 2025, and I had already outlined a version of the article back in December, and then the fires erupted in Los Angeles, in Pacific Palisades and Altadena, which happened to be two places I had lived while I was in college. I had lived in a community of many families up in Altadena, and I had I'd been house sitting out in Pacific Palisades for a year. And the stories, the seeing the footage of the fires and seeing the photographs and then reconnecting with the people I'd lived with, it was just devastating. And it's I can feel it viscerally. It is heartbreaking to see the destruction. But what remains are these friendships with the people I'd lived with. And so while I was experiencing this pain and suffering of the destruction of these places that I grew to love, I reconnected with people, and so it's balanced, or it's just this almost this roller coaster of emotions, because I feel so grateful for the opportunities to know those people, to have lived with those people. So yes, I was wrestling with a lot of emotions when I was writing this article.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to me. I'm not trying to make a false equivalency here between, you know, what you were navigating and your loved ones were navigating, what Francis was navigating when he wrote this, but it's very interesting to me that, you know, you're assigned this article that when people think of Canticle of the Creatures, they think of this beautiful poem that is praising God in creation. And yet Brother Fire, as you call it, is wrecking this place that you love as you're trying to write this article. And to me, that's really, I love this piece so much. And that's the architecture of it, is that just like Francis, this frail, very, one would maybe say a miserable, quite miserable, physically miserable time in his life, that's when this beautiful poem rises up. It's this collision, it seems, of suffering, of confronting the reality of suffering, and then also, well, there's beauty here too, and in a mysterious sense, there's God here too, and what does all this mean? And for Francis, he wrote a song.
He did write a song, and that makes it rather simple, but I think the collision, as you call it, is anything but simple. It is complex, and we tend to see one side or the other. There's all suffering or there's all beauty, and by noticing it's all together, and by noticing the beauty, you're not discounting the suffering. It's all there together. I think that is what brings depth to the canticle, but also depth to these experiences for me. I'm not dismissing the suffering by noticing the beauty that is arising in the rebuilding of these communities. And I understand there's great complexity in the rebuilding of these communities, great complexity and hardship. And there are beautiful relationships that are being forged. So it's both and I guess I could jump to talking about an image that I often use specifically to talk about Francis near the end of his life as he's writing this canticle, because I think it encapsulates much better than my own life stories or my own reflection. And that is from a statue that used to be at Mission Santa Barbara in California. It was a huge statue. It was probably 6, 7, maybe 7 feet tall. It was very big. It was on a pedestal, so it was even taller than that, 10 feet maybe. And it was made out of driftwood. So rather than just a branch of driftwood, imagine a whole tree of driftwood that someone had carved an image of Francis out of. And you can tell that Francis was originally holding maybe a bird in his hand in front of him. But as driftwood does, it was decaying. And it decayed rather quickly, but it decayed in one part. It decayed around the heart space. And this whole space here of the statue was gone. And that is where you could see that this log was really redwood. So as a colleague and a friend of mine, Sister Christine Still, noted in a retreat that I was giving, she said, notice that is the only place where you can see the true color of the wood, where it has disintegrated, where it has fallen away. And I feel there's so much wisdom in that insight that Sister Christine offered. You know, we build up our lives. Francis, too, he was building up his life by letting go. But in our careers, we build up a persona, an identity through our work, through our families. And really, when we let go of what is not essential, that is where the true color is, and that is in that heart space. So I hope that makes sense. I use that image a lot. I keep it a photograph of it above my desk just to reflect on daily, because I think that helps me with the natural process of letting go in life.
You've hit on it several times already, but this spirituality of letting go that your cover story really revolves around. In this movement that you invite the readers into, I mean, that image is so powerful. We could probably spend the rest of this podcast talking about that image. Like, the most authentic piece of the tree is shining through the brokenness of his chest, his heart. So this spirituality of letting go deeper into that for me. What does that look like in our everyday lives? And why do you think this is so important for people to perhaps contemplate or give a chance?
Yeah, I think a couple of things there. First of all, of course, still using that image of the statue, I would say that this heart space has been open to be filled with Christ. I mean, that is what Franciscan spirituality is about, to be Christocentric and to be filled with Christ, Christ's love, and to live into that love more deeply. And so what does that mean to me as a Christian, as a Franciscan Christian? Leads me to another aspect that I try to cultivate in my daily life, and that is to let go of my assumptions, let go of my expectations. Assumptions and expectations are all about controlling a situation, right? And to develop a sense of curiosity about the person I'm talking with, what is their perspective, curiosity about myself, you know, what's coming up for me in this time, in this moment? Am I feeling scared? Am I feeling nervous? Can I own that? And when I can really reflect deeply on my own experiences, then I can respond rather than react. And I think we have in Francis's life, and his trajectory of ongoing conversion, we have a lot of episodes of his reactivity. He gets really reactive to the leper at first, and then he starts working with that reactivity. In Celano's text, it's that he, in grace of God, allows him to turn around and face the leper again. That is true. And I also imagine that he had to work with him his own capacity to face the leper. And he had to do this over and over again. So I think it's both and. So those are some of the ways that I consider this spirituality in my life today.
Yeah, because Francis, even in the context of his relationship with lepers, I mean, correct me here if I'm wrong, but I mean, he's letting go. He's letting go of everything that he had been told growing up about who lepers were, why you should avoid them. He's letting go of his own judgments, his own kind of preconceived notions that he had about them. And I mean, it's easy to gloss over that, but that's a scary thing. Like, that is a scary thing to let go of thoughts, judgments, whatever it may be that you've been holding true, and you're realizing that, no, I'm off base here.
Absolutely. And I think there's even a gentler way, rather than self-judgment of I'm off base, but there is more here. There is more here than I knew. And can I open myself up? And that involves letting go of my assumptions and my habits, habits of judging, my habits of holding firm to certain rules or assumptions again. So there's a lot of vulnerability in this letting go. And it's no surprise that Francis's conversion was ongoing. And when I tell his life story, when I teach, you know, I feel that he was converting up until his very last breath, you know, up until he was meeting Sister Death. And there was this still ongoing letting go of expectations and rules. After all, he invited Lady Jacoba to be with him. And there was technically a rule of no women at the Portiuncula, but there she is. Because rules didn't serve in that moment. So he was really quite profound, and I think there's a lot for all of us to reflect on and to pray with in his life of ongoing conversion.
Yeah. Are there any other examples that come to mind for you in Francis's life, or Claire's life for that matter, where this spirituality of letting go is kind of unfolding? You mentioned the lepers, then you mentioned at the end of his life as well, where the canticle rises up from. I mean, he's letting go of a lot there as well. Anything else come to mind for you?
Well, you know, recently we celebrated the anniversary of the Nativity at Greccio. And the way I talk about the story of Greccio, because we can just start in Greccio itself, but if we go back a little bit, we recognize that the rule that was accepted by the Pope, the Regula Bullata, had just been sealed by the Pope. And this signals a new institutionalization of the order. And by all accounts, this was leading the order in a new direction, a way that Francis hadn't anticipated, and that wasn't his original vision. And so perhaps he left Rome saddened. Perhaps he felt dejected. Perhaps he felt depressed, or maybe unwanted, or, you know, who knows? But as a leader who has given up leadership of the order, and now seeing an institutionalization take place that he hadn't anticipated, it's not hard to assume that he was sad. And so what does he do? Instead of just going straight up to Assisi, it takes several days to get up there anyway, he sidetracks and goes over to Greccio. Not an easy place to get to. It's not easy, even today, it's not easy to get to. But he goes there for solace and for community and to share faith with the people he loves. He loves the people of Greccio. He knows them to be very faithful. They had devotional circles in their homes. He appreciated the depth of their faith. And that's where he goes to fill himself up again with the love of Christ. So in this time of what I think is sadness and perhaps doubt, he surrounds himself with people he loves, lay people, and they celebrate together the incarnation, the birth of Christ, in a new way and in a visceral way. So I think he was letting go perhaps of possibly some habit energy of reactivity, of judgment, possibly. That's just a speculation. But he finds himself surrounded with people of faith, and they develop this or create this beautiful commemoration of Christ's birth.
And I think that's really important for us to hit on here, is that when it comes to the spirituality of letting go, someone listening may think to themselves, hello, that sounds torturous. Why in the world would I do that? I like my control. I like my judgments. I like my certainty. However, from a Christian kind of theological perspective, I'm curious what you think about this, but God has been letting go. And we see that in the incarnation, this self-emptying, this kenosis, sometimes in my own life, when I'm struggling with letting go, I try to remind myself that by giving it a chance, I'm actually kind of aligning myself with the very trajectory of the Trinity, this Trinity that flows forth, that self-empties, the incarnation is, one reading of it would be that it's really quite out of control. Like God becoming a human person, becoming a baby who's dependent upon breast milk and is pooping himself and peeing himself and is completely dependent on his mom and dad to literally raise him to life and teach him and nurture him. I mean, that is incredibly, talk about letting go. I mean, that is and Francis was just absolutely intrigued, and even intrigue falls short of how much the incarnation meant to him. What do you have to add there?
Well, you're very theological, And I'm the first to say I'm not a theologian. I'm a historian. But I would say that my most important teachers in my life of faith, but also my life in general, without a doubt, the most important teachers I've had are those people I serve in hospice. The people who are at the end of life, who are letting go of everything. They don't have a choice. Some of them obviously do wrestle and combat this process of letting go. But I have learned so much about the wisdom of letting go from them that I've even let go of my own assumptions of how to be with people at the end of life. When I first started volunteering as a hospice caregiver, I thought it was all about talking with them and communicating with them. And so what happens, the very first person that I spend time with, we don't speak the same language. In fact, she spoke a language that no one understood. It was her own language. And across 2 years, we got to know each other over 2 years in hospice. We developed a very close relationship, a friendship, not through words, but by being together, by sipping tea together, by looking at books together, mostly by being together. So this letting go allows for more beauty than one could ever expect.
And it leads to a certain liberation or freedom, correct? Like when we think about the, sounds dry, but the practical implications of a spirituality of letting go, what we're talking about is how can I, my interpretation of it would be, how can I awaken to how free I already am? But my attachments, and this maybe this leads us to Zen and Buddhism, but my attachments are the things that are causing me suffering. You know, I think there's neuroscience to back this up too, where our brains tend to think about the conflict in our lives, the negative things in our lives, the things that lack resolve in our lives. So you have to train it to savor the positive things. And one way you train it is by letting go of the things that I'm trying to control. So do you have anything to mention there about freedom, liberation, like sell listeners on a spirituality of letting go? Because it's painful, is it not?
It is painful. And I'd actually like to start off by saying there are important ways of not letting go, right? Because when I look at my life trajectory, and I see this in Francis as well, he was trained to be a certain way, to have certain aspirations. And I think it's important to have goals. We build up our self-identity through education, through work skills, through career aspirations. And I don't disparage any of that in my life. And in fact, I can recall when I was in my 20s wanting to follow a completely spiritual path. And I remember telling myself over and over again, no, first you have to build up to let it go. And I don't know if that's the only way to do this, but that is what I felt I had to do. And I have been on this trajectory of letting go unexpectedly in recent years, and in ways that I didn't plan. So there it is. It's not something that you can control or plan or really delegate to others or to yourself. I really don't want to necessarily be in a position of selling this to other people. Everyone's on their own. I think in the end, for Franciscan spirituality, I think in the end, it is very much like what I've come to know in a Buddhist path of cultivating curiosity, of of saying to oneself, to myself, you know, I really don't know. I've made all these assumptions. I have all these expectations, but no, I don't know. And Buddhists call it cultivating don't know mind, beginner's mind.
I love that your article lands in this space of Thich Nhat Hanh, well-known Buddhist teacher, and the Zen Buddhism's alignment with the Franciscan's kind of spirituality of letting go. So for listeners who perhaps have not heard of Thich Nhat Hanh or Zen Buddhism, maybe talk about how his teachings and the teachings of Zen have been valuable for you in your own life and your own Franciscan spirituality.
Yeah, sure. Let me just focus on Thich Nhat Hanh and Plum Village tradition of Buddhism, because Zen Buddhism is even broader. And Thich Nhat Hanh, who just died in 2022, founder of what is called Engaged Buddhism or Plum Village Buddhism. He was a peacemaker. He was from Vietnam. He was exiled from Vietnam because of his opposition to the war in the 60s, at a time when he founded the Order of Interbeing. He was criticized for taking a radical stance of neutrality. This neutrality, which many Franciscans forget, that the secular Franciscans were originally founded on complete neutrality, that they were not to take sides in any conflict. So it's a deeply Franciscan element too. They quickly moved away from that, but there is that element in their history. But Thich Nhat Hanh, as a peacemaker, came to the what we call the West. He founded Plum Village in France. He spent time in the United States. He knew important peacemakers like Martin Luther King Jr., Thomas Merton. He had a great admiration for Francis of Assisi. And in fact, when I attend programs at Deer Park in San Diego County, which is a monastery in the Plum Village tradition, I think just about every time I attend a retreat, Francis of Assisi is mentioned at least once. There is this great resonance in between the two schools of spirituality, I think. For me, why I gravitate to Plum Village Buddhism is that I'm able to cultivate a sense of inner stillness along with curiosity. And it keeps me from my judgy self. I'm the first to admit how judgmental I am and how I was reared to be judgmental. And, you know, getting a PhD in history, you're reared to be judgmental and criticize sources and criticize people. But it is among practitioners of the Plum Village tradition that I have first seen and now experience myself a sense of inner stillness. So for me, the two are complementary. I couldn't be a Franciscan, I think, without engaged Buddhism. And I'm not just a Buddhist. I'm also a Franciscan Christian. The two come together deeply for me. It's all about quality of presence, I think. And that means even presence with myself, to notice my own tendencies or my own reactions. I just notice more without getting caught up in navel gazing. I guess that's the phrase we often use.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of my favorite books by Thomas Merton is Zen and the Birds of Appetite, where he's exploring intersection is not the right word because he's very... I'm no expert on Zen Buddhism, but he does a good job at the beginning of saying that like Christian mysticism is kind of wrapped up in a lot of theology. And in the West, we tend to attach ourselves to theological ideas, thoughts, principles, you know, all these different things. Whereas Zen, the way he explains it in his dialogue with D.T. Suzuki, is this is a philosophy. It's a like the great Zen phrase, don't think, see. don't think, look. And like, I think you're getting into something really important. It's a posture, correct? Like it's a presence and an awareness to, and I think there's overlap with Christian contemplation here too, but you're trying to see, I don't even like the word trying, that sounds like striving, but you're daring to see reality as it is and step into that reality with all of its messiness and to just observe it. And like you said, be curious about it. Am I on the right track there? Or what would you add?
I would add, just observe it is what you said. And I would say, be in it. I think it's really interesting. Another comparison with Francis and Thich Nhat Hanh is that both of them have been subject to criticism, even disparagement, as being superficial, as not being deep enough or philosophical enough. Thich Nhat Hanh was a significant scholar who worked in many languages and wrote important treatises. And he had the aspiration to bring this depth of being to a popular audience. And so he is able to write for a general audience, which is no mean feat. You know, it's very challenging. And so I know that many people also disparage or criticize Franciscan spirituality as being really just the spirituality of birdbaths. We've heard that before. There is a depth to Franciscan spirituality and to engage Buddhism because it's about living into these principles. It's not just about thinking about them and talking about them. It's about living into them. And that's where the depth is and the challenge is.
Yeah, how do you live into them?
So for engaged Buddhism, for Thich Nhat Hanh's tradition, he has the 5 mindfulness trainings and then the 14 mindfulness trainings. And these are trainings that do not contradict Christian practice at all, Christian faith at all. But these are guidelines, one might say, invitations. They aren't rules. They aren't things to you do this or you don't do this. These are guidelines in terms of how to live in a life of presence. And so it includes being mindful of what we consume, both in terms of what we read, what we look at on TV or the internet, what we consume and digest in our bodies, how much we eat and what we eat. That's just one example of one of the mindfulness trainings. And another example is right speech. You know, at what point, when are we open to articulating our views and thoughts? And when should we refrain so that we can be really deeply present in responding rather than reacting? So those are just a couple examples, but they're helpful guidelines for me to be living into a way that I aspire to live.
Yeah, you mentioned the word interbeing earlier. Mm-hmm. What did that mean to Thich Nhat Hanh?
The order of interbeing, and interbeing is a word that is used often in engaged Buddhism, and it's slightly different than a Christian notion because he would say that there is no individual self, that we all inter are. Now, that is not going to be something Christians will accept, and that's, I'm not asking anyone to accept that, but I am merely saying that it really opens up our heart to this notion of interdependence, that I have as much to learn from my students as my students have to learn from me. That is a pedagogical strategy and philosophy that I have as a professor, and that's an example of interbeing. I'm not going to take a top-down approach to teaching. I want to learn from my students as they learn from me, and that we all are in this world together to be together. It necessarily breaks down assumptions and expectations of a hierarchical view of the world and a hierarchical organization of the world. And I'm comfortable with that.
Yeah, is there some overlap there with, or maybe is it complementary to the Franciscan notion of relationality?
I think it's complementary to relationality, and I think Franciscan spirituality has been developed within a Western construction of hierarchy that I would be more comfortable with dismantling, or at least unraveling that hierarchy. But that's just me. I think implicit in Franciscan spirituality is a relationality that is grounded in curiosity to ask and to find out another person's intentions or meaning rather than to assume. And I think it's based on respect to keep communication open rather than to shut down based on office or hierarchy.
I think you can make a good argument theologically, and again, I'm not trying to be heady here, but just see the complementary kind of forces between Franciscan spirituality and Plum Village Zen Buddhism. Is that what it's called?
Yeah, Plum Village tradition, engaged Buddhism.
Plum Village tradition, yeah, engaged Buddhism. But when it comes to the Trinity in Christian theology, it's deeply relational. And it's not hierarchical. And if at the very core of all things is this relational dance, then, well, here's interbeing, interdependence, interconnectedness. We all inter-are, as Thich Nhat Hanh says. I mean, there's, and I can... And I want to get this back to lived experience because I think that's so important when talking about the Buddhist tradition. But I mean, this can help lead to a kind of integration, correct? Because of that notion of embodiment, because you're seeing reality as it is, you're stepping into the messiness of a situation or the pure beauty of a situation. Like, it doesn't always have to be like complex, but you dare to stand within it and to take it in and to not attach your thoughts to it, but to just take it in as it is. And this leads to, where does this lead?
I guess I just would like to continue where you're going with that, in that where it took me, where your words took me was, I think when we bring our whole self to a situation, and that is using Frank Ostasevsky's, one of Frank Ostasevsky's principles for Zen hospice, when we bring our whole self, not just our mind, not just our thoughts, but our whole self, and that involves in noticing our visceral responses, that is where the integration comes in, I think. And from all I know for sure is my own experiences, but I know growing up my brain was trained a lot, and I was trained not to feel as much, and yet I think naturally I feel a lot. And so this integration has come in time, across experience, and really letting go of some of the teachings and expectations that people around me have. I think in my hospice experience, really what is most heartbreaking to me is when I am encountering someone at the end of life who says, "I don't know what to think, tell me what to think. I don't know how to do this, tell me what to do." And I hope that in our life of faith that we can bring our full selves so that we can ask the questions along the way, that we can express our doubts and our faith and have open conversation so that we can explore the authenticity of our faith. So that when our last breath comes, or in the days preceding it, we're not in that space of uncertainty and relying on someone else to tell us what to think or be or do. And this doesn't lead to an arrogance. It just leads to a profound way of being in the world. A confidence without arrogance, you know, an authenticity that even allows for changing of one's mind and changing of one's habits, right?
Yeah, and for me, Zen and the contemplation kind of advocated by the mystics, by the Christian mystics, it's uncomfortable to me, perhaps as someone educated, conditioned by the West, I like to wrap something up in my thoughts. You know, I like to extract meaning from something. I like to, sometimes it's not even that I like to do it. It's just, I naturally do it. Well, this happened. Well, why did it happen? It must have, you know, point A must take me to point B. B must take me to C. And this is so challenging to me because it's like the ultimate practice of non-dualism where it just is. And in that, I can let go of, just like Francis, back to Francis again, I can let go of my judgments, I can let go of my meaning making, and I can just be in it, curiously, non-judgmentally, and it is, and I'm there in it. Is that so hard to find words for some of this stuff?
I know. It's what you just shared really helps me understand my own practice. Again, going back to hospice caregiving, I developed a practice of writing after each shift that I had, and I would write. It would really come down to about a paragraph, and these paragraphs that I would write would usually take me an hour to get to, because it wasn't just a linear delineation of what happened, but really it was a distillation of what I encountered. And when I look back on that series of, I have probably 200 of these paragraphs, when I look back on them, I think I always land at just what happened, just what is, not with any meaning or any understanding of someone else's experience, because I can't write about someone else's experience, but what I experienced encountering the person I was serving. And those writings that I shared were probably the most popular writings I've ever done. They weren't high philosophy. They weren't complete. They weren't super intellectual. It was just what is. I think we have gotten so far away from observing and being in our present moment that those writings were a balm to people who read them. There was just nothing special, and that's what made them so special.
In our own culture and society, we all see the stats about religion on the decline. However, it seems that people are more spiritually hungry than ever. And in a lot of this kind of quote unquote spiritual talk, there's a big emphasis on presence, like hey, be in the moment, be in the now, like be a present person. I'm not saying that doesn't have value, but the presence that you're talking about that goes back to raw encounter and taking everything in and standing there in the midst of it, even things that are deeply disorienting or confusing, and not judging them. That's a different kind of presence than what we normally hear, correct? Or what would you add there?
It's a deeper presence. You know, whenever anything is reduced to a slogan, there's going to be a superficial aspect to it. And people will talk about it in a catchphrase, and it remains up here. So cultivating a way of being present, and again, returning to the words of Frank Ostiseski, bring your whole self to the situation. That does mean this self-awareness and noticing what's coming up in every situation, and really slowing down. So one of the practices from the pandemic that I took up, I went deep into contemplative practice. For the first time, I was able to attend a retreat at the Kamaldolese order in Big Sur, because they started going online. And I deliberately slowed down my speech. And I've noticed I've continued that habit, and it's countercultural. So this might offend some listeners here, but I've just noticed a difference. I'm judging this difference too. I've noticed that in many Buddhist circles, they're very comfortable with a slower pace of speech. There's no tendency to interrupt. You can pause, even at length. And they'll do like you're doing, maybe not even nodding, just sit and wait for the completion of a thought. And in other circles in which I live and work, there is a tendency to jump in, to add something to, even my own sentences have been completed by many people over and over again. And so there is a spaciousness to this spirituality that I do see a difference in different religious cultures. And being deeply present, I think, necessarily slows down one's speech and allows for space for the completion of sentences and thoughts, and even allows for the silence to allow a sentence to land. With no need to add anything.
Yeah, spaciousness is a great word. Yeah, I really like that. Going back to the canticle, because there's a reason why you conclude your cover story with Thich Nhat Hanh, with Plum Village. Why did you end your article that way? What does all of this have to do with Francis's Canticle of the Creatures?
Well, I actually have just a very simple response to that. I was originally asked to write an interfaith approach to the Canticle of the Creatures. And so I had intended to bring in Franciscan spirituality and Buddhist, Plum Village Buddhism spirituality more centrally. And then the fire started. And I couldn't get there. I was stymied in writing that. That was the article I outlined in December. And so it was really the invitation to write an interfaith exploration of Franciscan spirituality that made me include Thich Nhat Hanh here. But that being said, I do practice within the Plum Village tradition. I am a member of a Plum Village Sangha in San Diego County. Even though I no longer live in San Diego County, I still help facilitate that Sangha. I am a member of the Order of Inner Being, and so this is just deeply important to me as a way of life. I think I shared earlier, I feel I can be more deeply Franciscan because of the Plum Village practices. Every Monday night, is Sangha. And with those people, I've shared often with them. It's such a privilege to be able to be silent with them. We meet on Zoom, and there might be 5 minutes, 20 minutes of complete silence. And it's not everybody that you can do that with. But it's not inconsequential. It's deep and meaningful and helpful.
When I reread your article, I'd be curious what you think about this, but to me, it brought it together so nicely, because in a way, that's what Francis was practicing during this very vulnerable time in his life. He had to have been incredibly miserable. He had to have been incredibly uncomfortable. And I mean, tortured in a sense too, with these mice running around him in the middle of the night, unable to sleep. And I mean, and yet it's like everything from his spirituality, his continual practice throughout his life of letting go, it like comes through mystically, magically in this moment where the canticle is birthed. It was a lifelong practice of letting go that allowed him to still connect to a beauty and goodness that he had always known. What are your thoughts there?
I agree with that summation that it is a lifelong practice. And if we don't practice this over the course of our life with all the ups and downs, the ebb and flow and when it's easy and when it's not, if we don't practice with all of that, then it's easy to come to a place where we just rather superficially bypass our own suffering, our physical suffering or emotional suffering. We disregard it. We don't even recognize it. And I have encountered people who don't recognize their pain, physical and emotional pain, because they've never had the opportunities to explore it and to experience it deeply. So I think where I'm coming from in my life now, having worked with Francis's life and the canticle and then writings about his life, is that it's a beautiful, complicated mess, and it's all okay, and it's all beautiful, and it's not superficial. And he didn't glibly welcome Sister Death. He didn't add that stanza until he was close to death. So this isn't just something that he wrote out. This is something that he lived into. And I pray for myself that I live into this depth of presence and experience. And earlier you were inviting me to teach the listeners here something, and I guess I would just invite everyone to live into the depth of their experiences as much as possible, and to glean the fruits of whatever's there.
The thing that is just so moving to me about the canticle and everything that you write about in your cover story and then what we've talked about here is that at this time where Francis could have felt very discouraged and isolated, everything was still relational to him. Like that. There's something so crazy to me about that.
I think it's so beautiful. I can remember a woman that I served in hospice who, whenever I would show up, she asked me to wheel her outside and we would just sit in a garden. We didn't talk, we just sat and we felt the wind on our cheeks and listened to the birds and smelled the pine trees. There is a settling in to being present that I think is a skill, actually. It is something that needs to be practiced in order to experience it fully. I think we don't honor stillness enough in our culture.
Talk about an invitation. I mean, that's it. I mean, the canticle, in a lot of ways, it goes back to Francis's own spiritual posture of stillness, I think.
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I mean, that's a part of Francis's life that we often don't talk about enough, about his experiences in hermitages, is his experiences of solitude, because we don't know, right? He didn't write out what he was doing, and we just know that he sequestered himself. He would be apart from the other friars. He might eat with them, or he might eat apart from them. But what happens in solitude? We have to speculate, but that is where the depth of this kind of presence can get cultivated. Not necessarily, but I think it did with Francis. And I think in our Franciscan world, among all of us practitioners, we tend to emphasize the doing, rather than the stillness and the contemplative side of this practice. And I think it would be wise to remember that Franciscan practice, or doing, is based in stillness. It's based in contemplative prayer. He lived in contemplation longer each year than in actual active ministry. So when he went to Rome and was serving with Lady Jacoba in the hospice in Trastevere, it was after weeks and months of contemplation.
Yeah, and in stillness and contemplation is such a challenge in our culture, you know, at least for me, because it's in that stillness that, for me, I'm kind of giving myself permission to not cling, to not jump to the next thing, to not root my own identity in my own doing, and instead just to be, and for that to be enough.
Yeah, I have two things to say to that. First of all, we see this, people heading into retirement age, how hard it is to let go of work. And we see this among lay people, we see this among vowed religious, when self-identity is based on what they've been doing, when the invitation is there to retire from the doing, many people are at a loss of their self-identity. So there's so much there to reflect on and to work with. But self-awareness of the struggle is the first step. The other thing that what you just said brought to my mind is, you know, I'm just going to tell you a short story from my youth. As a very young girl, like 4 years old, I would go into a closet and sit. I'd close the door, and there'd be a little crack, and I still remember what it looked like. I could see little particles of dust with the light coming through, and I just found so much peace there. It was, no one else in my family did that, and my parents were very concerned, very worried about me, because I would go into the closet. And apparently, I guess one time I fell asleep, and so my mom was frantic and started calling all the neighbors because she thought I was lost. But my point of saying all of those is that this can be instinctual for some people, but it's countercultural, and people are concerned about people who like to be alone, and it gets trained out of us.
Well, before you conclude here by reading the last couple paragraphs of your cover story, do you have anything else to add, anything I left out, or anything you would like to hit on before we kind of close shop here?
You know, we've covered quite a bit. I think we covered far more than I expected us to cover, so I think it's good. Did you want me to read the last two paragraphs? Is that it?
Yeah, I think that would be a great great place for us to conclude, Darlene. If you could read the last two paragraphs of your April 2025 cover story, and that cover story, again, is titled Living the Canticle of the Creatures. Francis's experience with loss illustrates a path to deeper relationships, including with God.
More than just thinking about the sibling connections Francis sang about in his canticle, I'm now sensing these connections with the world around me on a deep, visceral level. This is what Francis was getting at. Cultivating a rapport with this world that is not abstract or merely transactional, but instead experiencing the world viscerally, without judgment or denial, without resistance or avoidance, as a brother and a sister, with all the familiarity and tension implied in a family. It is an experience that could make us quite vulnerable, which is why much of the time most people run away from this closeness and disregard or trivialize this way of being with judgment. But when the realities of life hit and you've lost everything, what is left is the stunning beauty of our relationships with one another, with this world, and with our God. This path of interdependence is care-filled, relational, and felt. This is how we come to understand the real wisdom of Francis and begin to live the canticle.
Beautiful. Thank you for coming on Off the Page, Darlene.
Well, thanks, Stephen. It's been a joy.
Once again, that was Dr. Darlene Prides. Her cover story is available on our website, franciscanmedia.org, where you can also subscribe to the St. Anthony Messenger. I've dropped a link to her story, to the photo of Francis that we discussed in the episode, among other related links and helpful material in the show notes for this episode. If you feel inclined, please consider leaving a review of the podcast or visiting the donation link in the show notes to help us continue to create content like this. Thanks again to Darlene, and thanks as well to Father Cyprian Concilio for providing the music for this episode. This is Stephen Copeland signing off. Peace and all good.
I will lead you into the desert with me and tenderly speak to your